the previously scattered production activities into single-piece flow. Ultimately, most lean firms may want to do all of these things for their existing product lines. However, this may still not be enough. You may need an additional strategy, but it's best to devise it after you've changed the way you think and run your business, rather than making a desperation lunge at your problems beforehand. Once you've seen what lean techniques can do in your firm and reviewed the map of the entire value stream for every product family, you are ready to figure out what to do. The lean firms we have examined usually find that they can capture adequate growth and profits by sticking to what they know, often by acquiring related lines of business. What's more, they find that they can largely finance their acquisitions with the cash they free up in the inventories of the batch and queue firms they acquire. Those firms which do need to branch out into unfamiliar activities can do so by establishing product teams for each new product family and continually evaluating their performance against expectations. The virtue of this approach is that product families can be added or dropped without changing the fundamental structure of the firm. Remove the anchor draggers. In every organization we've looked at, there was a small group of managers, generally less than 10%, who simply could not accept new ideas. Hierarchical personalities needing a clear chain of command and something to control were particular problems. And in every successful transition we've examined, change agents, in looking back over their experience, wish they had acted faster to remove managers who would not cooperate. This sounds harsh, of course, but it is a simple lesson of experience. A small percentage of managers will move quickly to accept lean ideas. In marketing parlance, these are the early adopters. But the great mass will be undecided. The problem is with the few who will never go along, because they send an opposite message from the early adopters and take special pleasure in highlighting all the mistakes made along the path to leanness. This paralyzes the great mass in the middle and jeopardizes success. To repeat, as you begin the process, most managers and employees will not understand what you are doing, but will be neutral to positive if you make employment guarantees. Take action quickly to remove those managers who won't give new ideas a fair trial. When you fix something, fix it again. At the end of the first improvement initiative on an activity, tell the line management and the work team that in 3 months it will be time to fix it again. It's critical to get your employees to understand at the outset that there is always room for improvement. This will usually mean moving every machine and changing every job. In the early years of the lean transition, the lean promotion function will have to take the lead in planning successive improvement campaigns. Increasingly over time, however, improvement becomes the most critical job of the product team leader and the primary workforce. You must instill the idea that management is no longer about running activities in a steady state and avoiding variances. Instead, it's about eliminating the root causes of variances so they permanently disappear and managers can stop fighting fires, while improving performance in periodic leaps that never end. How much did you improve performance must become the critical question in evaluating managers. Most managers accept the intellectual proposition that improvement is never finished. Yet we repeatedly visit organizations that make an initial leap from mass to lean and then stop while talking endlessly about the endless journey. We were therefore delighted recently to revisit Freudenberg NOK, a firm that had already shown an aptitude for pursuing perfection over an extended period. On this most recent visit, we looked at an oil seal product and found a path of steady improvement for a full decade with no plans to quit. Freudenberg NOK made the initial leap with this product from process villages to cells in 1992 And this is the point at which many firms seem to stop. They followed up this first step with careful attention to the operation of the cells in order to create best practice and then model cells in 1993 and 1994. In 1995, they introduced pull systems throughout the facility to send production instructions to the cells and to remove products frequently at a fixed pace. In 1998, they undertook a production preparation process, sometimes called 3P, for a new product generation. And in 2000, they applied all the tools of Six Sigma to improve the capability of their process to a point where scrap is now less than 0.1% in an industry where no one else is below 1%. Perhaps a total productive maintenance program to obtain 100% equipment availability is next. In any case, the point is clear. It really is possible to continue improvements indefinitely for the same value stream. The question is whether value stream managers and their top-level superiors will emphatically demand truly continuous improvements, and whether the Lean Promotion Office can continually supply the necessary knowledge. Install business systems to encourage lean thinking. Once you've got momentum in the first 6 months of the transition and have rethought your organization over perhaps the next year, you're a long ways toward your goal of a lean transformation. However, additional steps are important to make the new approach self-sustaining. Once you've overcome the initial inertia, the number of proposals for improvement will snowball, and you'll need a mechanism for deciding what's most important to do now and what can wait until resources are available. You will also need to create a new way to keep score and to reward your people so they will continue to do the right things, and you'll need to make everything in your organization transparent so everyone can see what to do and how to improve. In addition, you will need a systematic method for teaching lean thinking to every employee, including to your customers and to your suppliers' employees along your value streams. Finally, you'll need to systematically rethink your tools, ranging from monster machines in the factory to computer scheduling systems, with the objective of devising right-sized technologies which can be inserted directly into the value stream for individual product families. Utilize policy deployment. We've tried to emphasize that to get started in a brownfield, you need to just do it. Get started and show some striking results. However, many companies take on too many lean initiatives once the ball is rolling. Therefore, it's vital to use the tools of policy deployment to reach agreement across your whole organization on the 3 or 4 lean tasks your firm can hope to complete each year. An example for year 3 of the transformation might be reorganize by product families, introduce a lean accounting system, Kaizen every major production activity, and Kaikaku order taking and scheduling. An even more important task for your annual policy deployment exercise will be to identify the task you can't hope to succeed at just yet, but which some parts of the organization will badly want to tackle right now. You'll need to publicly acknowledge that these are important, but they will need to be deselected until the next year or the year after, when the resources are available. In the past few years, we've had extensive experience with policy deployment in our own research institutes, and it's the hardest thing we've tried to do. This is because policy deployment forces senior managers to make painful choices as to what is really most important for the organization and what is truly achievable. At the same time, policy deployment exposes the contradictions between the plans of every unit of the organization as they impact on the other units. We wish we could say it gets easier, but in fact it doesn't. Old conflicts will always give way to new in any organization as long as it is growing or faces resource constraints. So the intensity of the policy deployment process seems to be a constant. What's more, we've found that the process can only be led by the senior executive. Paradoxically, we have discovered that the actual plans emerging from our policy deployment exercises are only good for about 3 months, despite our hopes and our initial expectations that they would guide our organizations for at least a year. As we've reflected on this, we've remembered a principle central to lean thinking. A value creation system must be flexible and responsive because forecasts are always wrong. And we realize that a policy deployment plan is nothing more than an organizational forecast, which future events quickly conspire to prove wrong. At first, we were bewildered, but then found that Toyota long ago discovered the same thing. Today, Toyota senior managers commonly note that planning is invaluable, but plans are worthless. Their conclusion is that going through the process forces everyone in the organization to understand the needs and constraints of everyone else, and greatly heightens consciousness about the most promising future path, even if the specific course of action chosen during the process needs frequent modification. Create a lean accounting system. Many firms today still run standard cost accounting systems, although many have made some movement toward activity-based costing. The latter is a great advance, but you can go even further. What you really need is value stream product-based costing, including product development and selling as well as production and supplier cost, so that all participants in a value stream can see clearly whether their collective efforts are adding more costs than value, or the reverse. Once you focus on your product family value streams, it becomes a lot easier to assign rather than allocate costs to products so that product team leaders and their team members can see where they stand. Your own accounting group should be able to figure out how to do this. You don't need a consultant. But we strongly recommend that you start with the chief financial officer and involve him or her in several weeks of hands-on improvement activities to get started. Then ask a simple question. What kind of management accounting system would cause our product team leaders to always do the right, lean thing? You will still need a financial accounting system for your profit and loss statement, a system which does strange things like value potentially obsolete inventories as assets, but you won't need or want to show this to your product team leaders. What's more, you will need to make a gradual transition from your current system to the new lean approach over a year or so to avoid chaos. Pay your people in relation to the performance of your firm. The ideal compensation scheme would pay each employee in exact proportion to the value they add, as value is determined by the customer. However, actually doing this would present insurmountable technical problems and could in any case only be achieved with enormous non-value-adding effort. We have found that in a lean firm, the simplest and cheapest method of calculating compensation is generally the best. This means paying a market wage to employees based on their general qualifications. For example, whatever assembly workers or entry-level product engineers receive on average in the geographic area of a facility, along with a bonus tied directly to the profitability of the firm. Because a lean firm should be substantially more profitable than an average firm, the bonus should be a significant fraction of total compensation. As you consider bonus schemes, it will quickly become apparent that the total amounts on offer, while substantial, will not be enormous. This underlines the reality that the primary incentive for working in a lean system is that the work itself provides positive feedback and a psychological sense of flow. We are often asked about incentive pay for employees in the manufacturing area and about adjusting compensation by product family. There's something to be said for both of these ideas, but on balance, we don't support them. Incentive pay is really a carryover from the old days of piecework and is sometimes used today to deal with the perception that work pace is harder in lean systems. In fact, the pace of minute-to-minute exertion is the same. The difference is that lean systems identify and eliminate practically all of the non-productive slack time for employees at every level. Therefore, it initially feels as if work is harder, but after a period of acclimation, when a lack of muda begins to seem normal, people often report that the pace is actually much easier than before. In any case, trying to buy the allegiance of your workforce to a lean system with cash is approaching the problem from the wrong direction. Instead, stress the positive aspects of the new work environment. With regard to separate bonuses for members of each product family, lean accounting makes them technically feasible, but we also think they're a bad idea. In a lean system, work tasks are evaluated very carefully by the work team itself to achieve an even pace with no wasted time. Looking across a firm, the pace of work inside each product family should be very similar. What's more, it will frequently be necessary to reassign employees from one product family to another, sometimes after an interlude in the lean production function, as the needs of the business change. Reassignment will generally create continuous conflict if bonuses vary from product family to product family because of varying competitive conditions in the marketplace. Make everything transparent. Benchmarking others usually wastes time you could better spend doing the right thing. However, benchmarking your internal performance, especially your rate of improvement, is critical. In addition, it's vital to create a scoreboard which everyone involved in a value stream can see to know exactly what's happening in real time. These don't need to be complicated or require significant investment. We're always amazed in touring lean firms at how much about the status and improvement trajectory of an operation can be shown with simple diagrams and process status boards. Many of these require little in the way of language or math skills to understand, yet they give a clear sense of what's happening. Teach lean thinking and skills to everyone. It has become conventional wisdom that higher levels of management should learn to listen to the primary work team, since they know the most about how to get the job done. Unfortunately, this bit of common sense is only half right. Your primary workforce probably does know the most about the hard technical aspects of getting isolated jobs done, including all of the deviations from poorly maintained official procedures, which are necessary to get products made at all. But what primary workers and frontline managers typically don't understand is how to think horizontally about the total flow of value and how to pull it. Nor do they typically understand the methods of root cause analysis needed to eliminate firefighting. Therefore, if you ask your primary workforce to implement lean techniques or permanently solve problems today, you are likely to get a rush of suggestions followed by general disillusionment when they fail to work properly. To gain the critical lean skills, your workforce needs training, but of a special type. One of us, Dan Jones, has worked with the Unipart Group in the United Kingdom to totally rethink skills acquisition and to create a Unipart University immediately adjacent to the value stream. While many firms have created corporate universities in campus settings in recent years, of which Motorola University is probably the best known, these mostly utilize dedicated faculty and offline learning activities. At Unipart, the faculty are entirely line managers, which means they must learn operational skills themselves, skills rarely mastered by senior managers in Western firms. In addition, the skills being taught must be precisely those needed immediately for the next phase in the lean transition. Thus, lean learning and policy deployment must be carefully synchronized so that knowledge is supplied just in time and in a way that reinforces the commitment of managers and all employees to doing the right thing. Everyone learns the same approach to problem solving, and everyone experiences the direct benefits of continuous learning, even though they may have left formal education many years ago. Over time, the investment in training can also be directly connected to the resulting improvements in the business. right-size your tools. By tools, we don't mean just production equipment, but also information management systems, test equipment, prototyping systems, and even organizational groupings. For example, think of a department devoted to a specific activity, let's say accounts receivable, as a type of tool. You can begin to rethink your tools from your very first kaikaku. However, your major monuments will present a major challenge, and one which can't be solved immediately. First, you will need to counter the ancient bias of your managers that large, fast, elaborate, dedicated, and centralized tools are more efficient. This, of course, is the cornerstone of batch and queue thinking. Instead, for every activity, you should ask them to work backwards by asking, what kind of tools would permit products in a given family to flow smoothly through the system with no delays and no backloops? And what type of tools would permit us to switch over instantly between products so there would be no need to make batches? As you think about this, you will be surprised to learn that many of your existing monuments, the lean thinker's term for equipment too massive to move, can be made much more flexible with a bit of creative thinking. You will be further surprised to discover that two small machines with only the features needed generally cost much less in total than one big machine with all the bells and whistles. Finally, you will be surprised to discover how much of your new tooling can be built inside your firm using excess materials at very low cost by excess people freed up by lean techniques. Consider throwing away your industrial equipment catalogs and getting directions to your local junkyard. The more you think, the more you will realize that you can provide most value streams with their own dedicated equipment to completely cut out bottlenecks at monuments and stoppages due to changeovers. Then when the value stream shifts its course, you can quickly redeploy your right-sized tools to serve new needs. However, tackling your major monuments and completely replacing them with right-sized apparatus will probably only get into full swing after several years of making the best of what you already have. Completing the transformation. When you're moving ahead at full speed, have your organization reconfigured, and have the appropriate business systems in place, probably after 3 to 4 years of strenuous effort, you're well on your way to a complete transformation. The final steps needed are to make sure that your suppliers and distributors are following your lead, that you are creating value as close to your customer as possible, and that you are making lean thinking automatic and bottom-up rather than merely top-down. Convince your suppliers and customers to take the steps just described. It's a rare firm today whose internal activities account for more than a third of the total cost and lead time needed to get products to market. The de-integration of Toyota starting in 1949, which eventually decreased its in-house cost added from 75 to less than 25% of total cost, has become the norm for firms across the world. Therefore, you will get only so far along the path to leanness, one quarter to one third of the way in most cases, unless you get your suppliers and customer firms to take the steps just described. It won't help much to hurl insults or place suppliers or customers against each other. You can make them mad and squeeze their margins, but these tactics generally do nothing for their cost and lead times because they simply don't know what to do. And as time goes on, they either find someone else to do business with or underinvest in product development or their distribution channels. The only alternative is to actually fix their production, product development, and order-taking systems by sending them your lean promotion team. This is also an excellent way to be alert to broader trends in industry, and to keep your lean thinkers sharp by continually exposing them to new situations. Don't do this until you've fixed your own activities, which the supplier or downstream firm link into, but then go as fast as possible and accept no excuses. We've done it quickly. We know you can too. Here's how. Let's get going. To make this approach feasible, it's obvious that you will need to winnow down your upstream and downstream partner list and prepare to work with them for the long term. When you go to help them, don't charge for your help. Instead, agree up front on how you're going to share the savings. It should be easy to get paid back, as well in better quality and shorter lead times for your products. Point out that there's an extra win for your suppliers in this win-win-win situation because they will learn how to cut cost and lead times on all of their activities, but will probably not need to pass these savings along to their other customers, who are still bogged down in short-term, market-based thinking. This is how Toyota and its Japanese suppliers both became fabulously wealthy. The suppliers, after learning from Toyota, sold to all of Toyota's direct competitors except Nissan at higher prices than they sold to Toyota, while steadily gaining business from these firms by underpricing batch and queue competitors in the supplier community. Finally, as soon as your suppliers and downstream customers start to improve their in-house performance, insist that they send their newly created process improvement teams to fix their own suppliers or downstream customers. Remember that your suppliers and downstream partners are typically no more integrated than you are. Set continually declining target prices and continually increasing quality and reliability goals, which make it impossible for them to relax. It will help this process to bring your first-tier suppliers together in a supplier association for mutual learning of the type long utilized by Toyota. Your first-tier suppliers may then wish to draw up a short list of second-tier suppliers they wish to work with. Then the resources of the first-tier suppliers can be concentrated on a much smaller number of second-tier suppliers. Similarly, the assembler firm near the customer at the end of the physical production stream may need to join forces with other lean-minded assemblers to take on the more intractable batch-head raw material suppliers and show them a better way. Buying raw materials in large lots at lower prices on behalf of your suppliers will seem like a much easier path. But this approach can only squeeze the margins of the raw materials firms unless someone shows them how to run their business in a different way. In 1996, we hope that the participants in the extended value stream, the firm stretching all the way from raw materials to the end customer, we're ready to go down a new path beyond meaningless partnerships and margin squeezing. However, in the giddy period of the new economy in the late 1990s, most firms seemed to focus instead on new information technologies, notably web-based reverse auctions, which were bound to show very limited results. Reverse auctions always seemed a dubious prospect to us, because unless the customer and the supplier can learn to remove costly waste from their joint value-creating process, there is an inherent limit on the degree of long-term price savings available to the customer by using the reverse auction tool. Specifically, the maximum saving is the amount of margin the supplier can afford to give away over an extended period while still remaining in business. And this is typically a very small number, only a few percent, because the great bulk of the supplier's price is determined by real costs resulting from the waste in the value stream. Recently, as customers and suppliers have found the limits of new IT tools and gone through one more recession-driven round of traditional price squeezing, we have introduced a simple mapping tool that can actually make the customer and the supplier better off by learning to see the whole flow of value. This is the extended value stream map that is the logical complement to the facility-level value stream maps, which we described earlier in our discussion of mapping value streams. The objective of this tool is not to perform costing studies, but instead to raise the shared consciousness of every participant along a given value stream about the performance of the whole stream, the causes of waste, and the best approaches to improvements that can make all participants better off. By taking a brief walk together, the participants in a shared value stream can quickly determine the current state and identify the magnitude and sources of the waste, which can then be turned into benefits. For example, on a value stream walk we recently conducted, we found that only 8 of the 73 steps performed to physically transform a product, a windshield wiper in this case, created any value for the end customer, the car buyer. And none of the 25 information processing steps actually created any value. Of the total time involved, only 54 minutes out of 44 days actually created value. And none of the 58 days elapsing between placement of an order by a customer and its transmission to the most upstream producer were of any value from the standpoint of the end customer. We also found that demand varied only about 3% at the customer end of the value stream, but gyrated by 40% at the most upstream producer, the raw material supplier. And as we continued our investigation, we found that defects were 7 times more likely and defective shipments to customers were 8 times more likely as we walked back up the stream. In consequence, large inventories were present at many points to buffer the system and protect downstream customers from shortages, and large amounts of rework and expediting occurred at every transition from one firm to the next. We could also see, however, that all of the wasteful steps and time were absolutely necessary because of the configuration of the value stream and the logic of the shared production process. Perhaps most important, no one looking at their stretch of the value stream alone had much hope of seeing the totality of the waste or of reducing it. On the basis of our walk, it was easy to envision a series of future states the participating firms might create that could make every firm better off. For example, simply agreeing to implement flow and pull within every plant touching the product should cut throughput time in half and eliminate 25% of the wasted steps. A subsequent step could introduce leveled pull with frequent replenishment between every firm and facility touching the product. This step could cut throughput time by another third, eliminate more wasteful steps, and reduce the number of warehouses and cross-dock facilities needed. Finally, if all of the production steps required for this product were relocated close together in a supplier park adjacent to the customer, it might be possible to shrink the total lead time from 44 to 2.8 days. That is to say, to within the time the customer is willing to wait for the product. If this could be accomplished, the whole value stream could be converted from make to forecast to make to order, with large cost savings for every firm. And we can even imagine a succeeding, ideal state employing a new generation of product designs and process technologies so that the manufacturer could produce completed wipers in a single step. This would eliminate practically all of the remaining effort and permit production to proceed in line sequence to exactly match the production rate and mix needed by the car assembler across the road. Few value streams will ever get this far, but the process of consciousness raising inherent in the mapping process can at least produce agreement among the value stream partners on the current reality and facilitate achieving one or more future states. If rules can be agreed on to split the benefits, and there probably won't be any benefits to split if they can't, this simple mapping process can produce truly meaningful partnerships for every value stream. Develop a lean global strategy. Some firms can exist happily by doing everything in only one place. For example, the Porsche car company can sell a modest volume of exotic cars to the entire world from one design, scheduling, and production site in southwest Germany. Ferrari can do the same thing from northern Italy. The mystique of their products protects firms of this type from knockoffs. In addition, volatility in some export markets, due to currency shifts or changes in taste, can be tolerated if no one market accounts for a large fraction of total sales. The world as a whole will still provide a stable enough market. Other firms may be happy to remain small, with plenty of growth potential in their home markets to utilize the resources freed up during the transition. What's more, expansion into related product lines will be sufficient to absorb resources in the future. Many other firms, however, like the major automotive, electronics, and aerospace firms and their first-tier suppliers, need a global market and production presence. The adoption of lean thinking will call for a very different strategy from many of those being pursued today. Many people initially believe that lean techniques are mostly about cost reductions. In fact, they provide the one feasible way to cut cost while also shortening production lead times and time to market, improving quality, and providing customers with exactly what they want, precisely when they want it. These techniques also make it possible to design, order, produce, and deliver goods at smaller production scale by means of dedicated product teams and without paying a scale or investment cost penalty. It follows that for most products with global market potential, the correct global strategy is to develop a complete design, order-taking, and production system within each major market of sale. This makes it much easier to communicate with the customer and also makes it possible to design, produce, and deliver the product very quickly with just the right specifications. High-tech mass production at a centralized global location and a far-flung design and production system seeking to find the lowest wage cost for every activity along a complex value stream can never achieve these combined objectives. These alternative strategies optimize one course of the value stream at the expense of the whole. In the years since the launch of lean thinking, we've been amazed that many firms in the manufacturing world have continued to pursue mass production logic with respect to production location. They have disaggregated their value streams, seeking to place each processing step with significant labor content in that global location with the lowest wage costs, and seemingly locating the processing steps as far apart as possible. The consequence is that many points are optimized, but the whole surely is not. For example, we recently talked with a household name shoe company that has moved all of its shoe assembly for products sold in North America to Southeast Asia. This has lowered the labor cost per shoe from the level previously achieved in Mexico, but it has also greatly increased the time needed to get products to the customer. The 20 weeks of lead time in the new system effectively make it impossible to reorder during the short selling season of its models. Instead, this firm places all orders with its contract manufacturers on the basis of forecast and ends up remaindering 40% of its shoes in secondary sales channels at very low prices. And this does not count the lost revenues from customers who visited retail stores or the manufacturer's website and failed to find the models they wanted due to out-of-stocks caused by inaccurate forecasts. Similarly, we recently encountered a large electronic components manufacturer that some years ago decided to retain its capital-intensive part fabrication in the United States and Canada, but move its labor-intensive assembly operations to northern Mexico. As competitors have duplicated this strategy, moving assembly out of the United States, and as Mexican wages have started to rise, the firm is now looking to transfer its assembly operations to China are to Vietnam, still shipping parts from the U.S. We ask a very simple question. Instead of shipping parts from the U.S. to China and finished products from China to the U.S. with many, many weeks of cumulative lead time, why not move all of the parts fabrication next to the assembly operation in Mexico so the product can be ordered and shipped within 3 days to North American customers? This mass production logic is also applied to the location of engineering. We recently visited the Mexican engineering center of a well-known multinational firm in the electronics industry and found a large team of engineers hard at work on a product to be manufactured in Poland for sale in Europe. We immediately had some simple questions. Don't any Polish engineers know anything about electricity? We can understand why you, the multinational, has sought out cheaper engineering resources for your relatively mature product, but why not locate the engineers next to the point of production to gain the many benefits of co-location? After reflecting on these experiences, which seem to be typical, we've developed a very simple way to think about location for producers currently in high-cost areas. Let's call it lean math and use the following algorithm. Start with the piece part cost of making your product near your current customers in high-wage countries, that is, the U.S., Western Europe, Japan. Compare this number with the piece part cost of making the same item at the global point of lowest factor cost, probably dominated by wage cost. The low factor cost location will almost always have a much lower piece part cost. Add the cost of slow freight to get the product to your customer. You've now done all the math that many purchasing departments seem to perform. Let's call this mass production math. To get to lean math, you need to add some additional cost to piece part plus slow freight cost in order to make the calculations more realistic. First, add the overhead cost allocated to production in the high-wage location, costs which usually don't disappear when production is transferred. Instead, they are reallocated to remaining products, raising their apparent cost. Then add the cost of the additional inventory of goods in transit over long distances from the low-wage location to your customer. Then add the cost of additional safety stocks to ensure uninterrupted supply. Next, add the cost of expensive expedited shipments. You'll need to be careful here because the plan for the product in question typically assumes that there aren't any expediting costs, when a bit of casual empiricism will show that there almost always are. Then add the cost of warranty claims if the new supplier has a long learning curve. Next, add the cost of engineer visits or of a resident engineer at the supplier to get the process right so the product is made to the correct specification with acceptable quality. Then add the cost of senior executive visits to set up the operation or to straighten out relationships with managers and suppliers operating in a very different business environment. Note that this may include all manner of payments and considerations, depending on local business practices. Then add the cost of out-of-stocks and lost sales caused by the long lead times to obtain the correct specification of the product if demand changes. Now add the cost of remaindered goods or of scrap stocks ordered to a long-range forecast and never actually needed. Then add the potential cost, if you're using a contract manufacturer in the low-cost location, of your supplier quickly becoming your competitor. This is becoming quite a list. And note that these additional costs are hardly ever visible to the senior executives and purchasing managers who relocate production of an item to a low-wage location based simply on piece part price plus slow freight. However, lean math requires adding three more costs to be complete. First, currency risk. These can strike quite suddenly when the currency of either the supplying or the receiving country shifts. Second, country risk. This can also emerge very suddenly when the shipping country encounters political instabilities or when there is a political reaction in the receiving country as trade deficits and unemployment emerge as political issues. Third, connectivity cost. These are the many costs in managing product handoffs and information flows in highly complex supply chains across long distances in countries with different business practices. These latter costs are hard to estimate, but are sometimes very large. The only thing a manager can know for sure is that they are very low or zero if products are sourced close to the customer rather than across the globe. If you do your lean math, what does it usually say about location? We found that most products fit into one of three categories. First, for products where rapid customer response can substantially raise sales and selling prices. These, for example, would include the higher-end shoes produced by the firm just mentioned. You should work hard to conduct every step of the production process as near the customer as possible. In many cases, the full application of lean techniques to production steps, which are located immediately adjacent to each other, a process we call value stream compression, can produce an acceptable combination of higher revenues and lower cost, even in a high labor cost location. Second, for products which are more price sensitive, but where rapid customer response is still important, co-locate all steps in the design and production process, that is, compress the value stream, including engineering, at a low labor cost site within the region of sale. For the U.S. and Canada, this will usually be Mexico. For Western Europe, it will usually be Eastern Europe. By using trucks, which are fast and cheap, rather than boats, which are cheap but slow, or airplanes, which are fast but expensive, it will be possible to replenish products in 2 or 3 days as they are sold or consumed, rather than waiting weeks or maintaining large just-in-case stocks near the customer. Remember, lean thinkers love trucks when transport is needed at all, but they try to eliminate boats and planes. Third and finally, for commoditized products that have a fairly high value-to-weight ratio and where demand can actually be forecast due to stable sales over the long term, co-locate all production steps at the lowest labor cost point, even outside the region of sale. Note once more that the best approach is to compress the value stream in order to conduct as many steps as possible, including engineering, at the low-cost point. This requires only a single transport link to move the finished item from the point of design and manufacture to the market of sale. However, even when these conditions are met, bear in mind currency risk, country risk, and the connectivity cost that are inherent in managing the decompressed value streams. It's our belief that when all these factors are weighed, this third category is much smaller than most managers currently think. Convert from top-down leadership to bottom-up initiatives. Initially, the process improvement group will work top-down because the pressing need is to change the way your employees think by directly demonstrating a better way. Over time, however, the process improvement group will focus more on making every line manager a sensei and every employee a proactive process engineer. The function can then tackle only the very toughest problems, where line managers still need outside help. This is the present-day assignment of the Operations Management Consulting Division within the Toyota Company. One of the paradoxes of lean thinking is that the ideas themselves are extraordinarily anti-hierarchical and pro-democratic. Every worker inspects his or her own work, becomes multi-skilled, and participates in periodic job redesign through Kaizen activities. layers of management are permanently stripped away. Transparency makes every aspect of the business open for everyone to see. Yet getting the critical mass of employees to change their traditional way of thinking requires stern direction, as employees are commanded to try things which may seem completely crazy. So there is a critical transition as you move your organization through the lean transformation, a point when managers must become coaches rather than tyrants, and employees become proactive. This transition is the key to a self-sustaining organization. And please note, if you are the change agent, you may become the biggest problem. We've encountered more than one change agent who wanted to continue commanding change from the top when those on the bottom were quite capable of sustaining it on their own. This can easily become a negative-sum situation. One solution is to change your behavior. Another is simply to move on. Many of the best change agents we've encountered seem to work best by converting an organization over a period of several years, then turning senior management over to a more collegial personality, and moving on to another firm, still full of concrete heads. As we've gained experience in recent years, we've become ever more aware that in a truly mature lean business, there is a transition from policy deployment to policy management. This happens when there are value stream managers for every value stream, and employees across the enterprise have learned to see. As a result, ideas for further improvements in every value stream continually bubble up to senior management, which needs only to reconcile conflicts and make sober judgments on just how many improvement initiatives can be supported at one time. The consequence of this happy situation was brought home to us recently in a conversation with a senior manager at Toyota in talking about the current state of affairs in the motor industry. He noted that Toyota, at this point in its development, obtains brilliant results from average managers improving already brilliant processes, while its competitors often obtain mediocre or worse results from brilliant managers struggling with broken processes. The natural instinct in this situation is to find more brilliant managers. And many American firms went down during the bubble economy with only brilliant hands on deck. The correct response is to perfect the process, the value stream, for every value-creating activity, and then rejoice in the fact that average people, and this group, if we're honest, includes most of us most of the time, can get brilliant results and get them consistently. A few brilliant process thinkers may still be needed, but to tackle the most difficult problems in perfecting every process, as average managers bring these issues to senior management's attention as part of policy management. The inevitable results of a 5-year commitment. Whenever we encounter a would-be change agent who wants to transform his or her firm, we ask a simple question. Are you willing to work very hard, accept the one step backward, which comes with the two steps forward, and stick to your task for 5 full years. Completing the transformation typically takes at least this long. While a few firms can go much faster if the change agent is firmly in command and has done it all before, this extended period is usually needed because a large number of people, including the senior leadership, must be taught to see the difference between value and muda. In a significant period of experimentation by ordinary managers, complete with backward steps, is necessary before everyone begins automatically to apply lean thinking and move the organization ahead from the bottom in the middle ranks. It's only at this point that the change agent can step in front of the bus without being missed, and it's at this point also that the full financial benefits of lean thinking are apparent. From this point, we believe there will be no turning back, and the change agent may even want to move on to a new challenge. Today, there is an enormous amount of cynicism in the industrial world as a result of the collapse of the bubble economy. However, a growing fraction of managers seem to understand that real change and building a solid foundation simply take time. We believe, based on conversations with many of you, that you're willing to rise to the challenge if you are sure that something is really there at the end of the rainbow. One of our major objectives in lean thinking has been to show that there is. If you are really determined to be the change agent, and you get a good sensei, we guarantee you will achieve extraordinary things. The techniques we have described in the earlier chapters have been tested around the world in a variety of industries. They always work. Of course, even a brilliant performing firm can fail for reasons beyond anyone's control. An unsuspected environmental problem, a drastic change in consumer taste, the sudden appearance of a new technology. Nevertheless, with a lean toolkit, the chances of succeeding in your chosen activities will soar. The opportunity now at hand. As we've noted at a number of points, recessions are precious things because they shake conventional wisdom and motivate managers to make hard choices. The current era is no exception, and we are currently at the point of greatest opportunity during the boom-bust-boom cycle that still plagues market economies. This is because unnecessary investments, and investments in the wrong place, can still be avoided as the economy begins to expand from the trough, while the dispiriting job losses of the down cycle are past. But the window of opportunity stays open only for a limited period before tradition reasserts itself and false confidence in a firm's processes sets in. The stories in this book are those of firms who were forced to look in the mirror during the recession of 1991 and who found a new and better way of living as lean thinkers. They not only did well during the boom of the 90s, but have also prospered in the ensuing recession. The question now is which firms, many we hope, will seize the opportunities of the recession of 2001-2003 to become the next wave of lean thinkers, pushing the whole economy ahead. We have all the necessary knowledge. Indeed, we know much more about the lean transformation than we did in the 1990s. There is, therefore, no excuse for failing to act in this golden moment for lean thinkers.
Lean Thinking was written by James P. Womack and Daniel T. Jones, and read by James P. Womack. It was abridged for audio by Jan Werner. The recording engineer was Peter Turpin, with editing by Michael Raphael. The associate producer was Kelly Gilday. Lean Thinking, Banish Waste and Create Wealth in Your Corporation, Second Edition, was produced and directed by Jocelyn Gonzalez. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.